You're listening to the Dana and Parks podcast on KMBZ.
We are so excited. This is going to be one of the greatest exhibits that Union Station has ever brought to town. The Berlin Wall. It opens today, I believe.
The media preview is tomorrow, and then opens to the general public on Friday. The Berlin Wall, A World Divided. And we just got a book, by the way, and thank you guys so much for this. Just chock full of information and artifacts. And on the front of the book, we're going to get to this. It looks like a very young man, late teens, early 20s, and he's up on stairs or steps of some sort. And it's just a photograph of him from behind. He's peeking over the wall.
From the west to the east.
From the west to the east. Just, I've always said, still photography tells a story like no other. It is an incredible snapshot in time. And we are thrilled to have the director of the Berlin Wall Foundation, Dr. Axel Klausmeier, here with us today. And exhibit director Luis Ferrero, back to the Dana and Parks program. It's good to see you again. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so very much for having us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
What are we going to learn that we didn't already know?
Well, first of all, I think it's about that we should really take seriously the values of democracy. The Berlin Wall is about has very, very many stories. It's about oppression. It's about state violence. It's about walling in its own population. This is what the communist regime did. And it's also about the incredible wish for freedom, for democracy. And this does say very much about our today's world, our responsibilities for the values and for defending freedom.
And we're going to see these that Axel was saying through more than 200 original artifacts displayed for the very first time here in U.S. territory. So we have like very, very large pieces. We have more than 10 tons of the wall itself.
What is the largest piece of the wall that you have?
Well, I think we have like almost 10 meters of the wall itself. And these are, of course, very impressive, very frightening when you see it, actually. But the most important thing of an artifact is not actually what we see, but what we can learn out of it. So we display these artifacts because most of them have a very strong human story behind. And we let them speak for themselves. We believe they have a story. And there is a conversation. Every exhibition, in a way, it's a conversation between history and present, between the artifacts and the visitor. And we display these artifacts to tell the human story that lies within the Berlin Wall, framed also very importantly in the international Cold War framework. So it's very important that we understand it is not possible to really get the meaning of the Berlin Wall without understanding this global confrontation of the Cold War.
Let's talk a little bit about the separation of families and friends and the three decades of heartache and death, and how you bring those stories, humanize those stories. And I go back to the photograph of the young man peeking over that wall. Remind everybody first, he reached out to you.
We were in Paris with the exhibition at the Museum of Architecture, and we got this email. We got many emails from people who tell us, I surfed in Berlin, or I have a small piece, or I was there just 1 year after it fell, and so on. And we got this email from he was then a young man, but now a senior who actually claimed to be the man in the picture. And he sent us then all the information, pictures of himself in that precise moment, and we were able to trace him back. His name is Stefan, and it was just amazing. And it's one of those stories, as you were saying, sometimes a picture, an artifact, reveals a lot more than just what we see. And in that picture, he's overlooking the wall from the French sector, if I'm not mistaken. I think these ladders were placed there, actually, so that people could see from the west.
There were platforms in the west originally erected by the West Berlin and by the Western Allies, West Berlin police and Western Allies, to overlook the wall, to survey what was going on in the Death Strip and in the East. So, and then very soon in the early 60s, they turned into sort of touristic sites, because the Berlin Wall from the very beginning was a touristy attraction. And then people were standing on it, watching people in the East, and the people in the East, they felt like they were in a zoo.
Oh, I was just going to say, what? That's the exact word that came to my mind, like they were in a zoo.
Yeah, that's how it felt. And when we interview people from the former East, that's what they're always saying. Oh, there were these stands and so forth where people climbed up in the West, which was a very, very ordinary procedure. And we felt like that.
Was that dangerous for them? Because if I remember correctly, and I had been to Berlin twice, the wall was technically 4 feet inside East Berlin. So they were technically in East Berlin they're looking over the wall. Is that right?
No, the fact is true. It was always, the wall was always standing on Eastern territory so that Western forces could not intervene. That is the, there was the borderline, the technical borderline, but the actual wall, the foremost Western element, because the wall, the term the wall is actually incorrect, because it was a whole sequence of various obstacles. It was not just one wall, but several. And in between this border strip, this what we always refer to as the death strip, there were the border guards with an order to shoot to kill. So the border guards were the deadly element in that and had the order to not let anyone through. But to come back to your question, these stands, so to speak, they were always on Western territory because they were erected by the West Berlin police and by the Western Allies.
Did the wall circumvent the entire city or just the border between West Berlin and East Berlin?
No, it was around the entire three Western sectors, the French, the American, and the British sector. And so altogether, it was more or less 100 miles, which is 155 kilometers. So encircling West Berlin. So this free island, so to speak, the island in what then used to be East Germany, because of, as one knows, the Germany was divided after the war in four sectors, and in the Soviet sector, in the middle of the Soviet sector, was Berlin. Berlin again divided into four sectors, and these three Western sectors were encircled by the wall.
How many people died trying to escape? And then of those, do you have a breakdown between those deaths that were murder and those that that died of other, in other ways, trying to gain freedom?
We have at least, we know of at least 140 people that died at the border. But there were approximately or more or less exactly 103 people that really died escaping from east to west. These 103 people were either shot by border guards or they drowned were shot and then drowned in the rivers, because Berlin has a lot of water and the borderland was also with water. And then we have at least 28 people without any intention to escape. And we also have 8 border guards killed on duty. And these border guards, East German border guards, were killed by people that tried to escape. And sometimes we even have the situation that someone tried to escape from the East, killed a border guard to shoot his way free into the West, and then the second border guard killed the person that escaped. So that was an immediate sort of firing exchange. And and then, as I said, there are at least 28 persons without any intention to escape, and among them are, very sadly, children. Children that were brought up in the West, in the Western sector, and they fell into the rivers. And they and no one dared to rescue them because on the eastern side, the border guards had an order to shoot to kill. And one could not really save.
Even to save a child.
Yeah. So what does it tell us about the system? That means that this so-called security of the border in military terms, the security of the border was more important than a human life.
When we get back, the ways the people made it over the wall, balloons, catapults, it was 13 feet tall, and people catapulted over the wall. We'll get to that in just a moment here on Dana and Parks. So it opens this week, the Berlin Wall exhibit at Union Station. It is going to be absolutely fascinating. Opening night is Thursday night. I think tonight or tomorrow is media day.
Yep.
Yeah. We're joined by Alex Klausmeier, the director of the Berlin Wall Foundation, and Luis Vieira, the director of the, I'm going to mispronounce this, Musealia?
Musealia, yes.
I'm sorry.
Close enough. Okay. Yes, absolutely.
That's fine. we were talking about, sadly, the number of people that died trying to get from East Berlin to West Berlin. But there were some success stories, and they were rather unique. People would pole vault over the wall. They would use hot air balloons to get over the wall. And there were some success stories, were there not?
There were, yeah, and especially in the very beginning, in the years, until the mid-60s. So the wall went up more or less 65 years ago on August 13, 61. And so we are commemorating the 65th anniversary this year. In the beginning, there were tunnels because it was so densely... Berlin is so densely populated, and in some parts of the city, there were successful tunnels. In Bernauer Straße, where the Berlin Wall Memorial today is, there were two successful tunnels. One was actually filmed by and financed by the NBC at the time. So this was Tunnel 29. And there was another success story, Tunnel 57. And these figures come from the persons that made it through the tunnel. 29 people in one night and 57 people in two other nights.
Is that
nights.
The final number that we know of people that were successful in going across?
No, it's just in these two tunnels. No, we cannot name the exact figure because there are stories and it's very much dependent on what you're talking about, whether these people immediately crossed the border, the frontier, the border element, so to speak, or whether they took other ways. For example, there is a couple we know of. They moved from East Berlin to West Berlin via China. So they actually escaped through the Soviet Union, went into the West German embassy in Beijing, and were from Beijing flown out into West Berlin. So from before they left, I mean, there were 300-500 yards between their original home in the east and their new home in the west, but they had to go via Beijing. We know of other stories where people used countries like Bulgaria, mm-hmm. Romania, from where they escaped, because that was safer than trying to cross the Berlin Wall, because, as I said earlier, it's the order to shoot to kill, that order of the border guards.
And the wall literally cut occasionally right through a home. Is that correct?
Yeah. In some streets, like Bernauer Straße, many, many houses were pulled down to make way for the border strip. So they were pulled down, and the houses there in this very street were just in the east, whereas the walkway in front, the access to the houses, was already in the west.
Can you help us understand, when in the very, very beginning when this first started, you have houses right there. When was the final warning was there a final warning as the wall is going up, that if you, how did people, did they have lead time to take their family to move, or did it just happen?
It happened. So there was, of course, no time for preparation. It was overnight from Saturday to Sunday, and that is what the East German regime took into account. Had they sort of given notice prior to this event, people would have escaped like crazy. So all of a sudden they were walled in, and their own population, and on these houses right on the border, people simply jumped out of the window and taking the risk. And the first victim of the wall, Ida Siegmann, a woman of approximately 60 years old, she jumped out of from the first fourth floor and suffered into
fourth floor
from the fourth
so
floor.
So it happened overnight.
It happened overnight, and that was the surprise effect, so that people could not escape. But of course, we are talking about a city of 3 million people at the time. And there were friends and families divided overnight, because whatever, your parents lived in the east, you lived in the west. And there were, for example, family feasts, parties at this weekend. And
so you go to visit your mother on the other side, then overnight the wall goes up.
And by Monday you don't get to see her ever again.
Or other way around, and your children were, for example, still in the east, where you were having the party in the west, and you could not go back. They would not let you in again, only after serious negotiations. And this was true for both directions.
Luis, very quickly from the text line, is the wall authentic, or is it a replica?
Oh, no. The pieces that we have are all originals. And actually, many of the stories that we have heard from Klaus, we have a piece of Tunnel 29. We have the original footage displayed in the exhibition. We have the memorial for the first victim. We have many of the artifacts that people from Bernauerstrasse, they had basically in seconds decide, what do I take with me? And some are very small things, very personal things, like a teddy bear or things like that. Mm-hmm. So when you see these artifacts is when these stories actually become alive. And as I said before, they are the they take the weight of the narrative, because it's a very complex story, geopolitical story, that what the exhibition does, I think, so well is to bring it down to the human level. What does this really mean for normal people like you and us? And actually, what the exhibition does very well, both in artifacts and in testimonies, is on both sides. Once the wall is the border is closed, we actually have testimonies and artifacts on both sides of the wall.
Can you stick around for one more segment?
This is fascinating.
Just for a couple more minutes? Can they stay a couple more minutes? I want to know, when we get back, was anyone ever brought to justice for the murders of those who tried to escape to their freedom? And then one of my earliest childhood memories is watching a movie about someone in a hot air balloon going over that wall. Yeah. And I remember my parents trying to explain it to me. I couldn't understand it as a child. I want to ask you about the hot air balloon when we return. Yeah.
So it opens this week, the Berlin Wall exhibit at Union Station. We're joined in studio. This is a fascinating conversation with Dr. Axel Klausmeier, who is the director of the Berlin Wall Foundation, and Luis Fierro, who is the director of the Musealia.
Okay. Real quick, gentlemen, I would have been 8 years old when my mother found the movie, or had us sit down and watch the movie. It was a Walt Disney production called Night Crossing, and the only thing I remember was fear. I remember being very afraid watching the movie, because you know these people were in danger. I didn't understand it. I was 8 years old, although that was in a different area, depicting this escape in 1979. People did use hot air balloons to try to get over the wall.
Yes, they did, and they did successfully, but the last victim of the wall also used a hot air balloon, and unfortunately, sadly, died in March 89, so only 8 months before the wall came down. So he tried to escape together with his wife, but his wife, she spied for the Stasi, for the secret police, and in the very last second, she decided not to get into the balloon to take off. So he went into the balloon, And it was March, it was cold, he felt unconscious, and the hot air balloon made it from the east to the west, and then it fell down very close to the Schlachtensee, to one of the very beautiful lakes in West Berlin, and he suffered from serious internal injuries and died.
Doctor, explain this to everyone. I remember years ago when I was 16 going from Checkpoint Charlie in the west to East Berlin. And we were on a bus. I was with my high school soccer team. And I remember once we got to the east, the tour guide or whoever was in front of the bus said, turn and look at the buildings behind you. And so when you were in the west, looking into the east, there were these big apartment buildings on the other side of the wall. But when you turned and looked, they were empty. They were three-sided facades. Tell us about that.
Well, they were kept empty because they were literally standing right on the border. And that meant that they could not be used anymore for civic or any purposes, because when you were living in these buildings, you would have kind of access into the border strip. And that would have meant that another 30 meters and you're in the west. Yeah. So therefore, they were left empty, although it was an extreme shortage in the east of flats and places to stay. And some of the houses were actually used, but who lived in those buildings? Either people who were absolutely reliable, so party members, or elderly who could not escape on their own, or, and that is an interesting thing, international students from so-called brother states like Cuba, like Vietnam, like Angola, like Mozambique, so countries of the communist world. And those international students, and this is what we all know when we go abroad.
Yeah.
First, you don't know anyone. So if you don't know anyone, you don't get any visitors.
Yeah.
So you can live in these places very close to the border without sort of the danger that they would run off into the west.
Was anyone ever brought to justice for the murders of those trying to cross?
Yeah, several. I mean, not only some of those border guards who actually and literally shot and killed people, but also high-rank officers that were actually politically responsible for the whole border regime. They were brought to justice, but in the early 1990s, they were already taken to court following West German justice and juristical procedures. And following these rules and laws, and since they were already very old and frail, they were set free after 2 or 3 or 4 years.
Oh. Luis, I remember going into East Berlin, and it was very gray.
Mm-hmm.
All the cars looked... Am I wrong?
No, absolutely.
It was very gray. All the cars looked exactly the same. The buildings were the same. Everybody walked around with their heads down. Do you guys get into that with this exhibit?
So what we do is basically tell the story through the artifacts, and the artifacts will see the difference. You will be in the front lines and experience what it was to live on both sides. But we don't try to preach easily people. We present the facts, the stories, the real artifacts, and basically we let the visitor make up their mind about and judge, of course, the stories. But people will certainly be able to have a clear understanding of what it meant to live on one side or the other of the world.
How important is it to for our young people to see this and to understand? We're talking the early 80s when the wall came down.
Late
80s, pardon me. This is not that long ago. And if you had said to somebody, okay, this is what's going to happen politically, there's going to be this division, and they're going to wall out an entire population of 1.3 million, or we would say that's insane. But not only did it happen, it wasn't that long ago this happened.
Mm-hmm. No, it's... you were asking about young people. It's, I mean, the wonderful thing with this wall is that it has a kind of happy end. It's, you know, the wall is, although all these fatal stories and the tragic stories, this wall is overcome peacefully without a single shot fired. A dictatorship has been overcome by the power of the people. That is what has to, in that respect, Berlin is a place of hope. It's a place nowadays that really shows that dictatorships can be overcome peacefully, and that is a wonderful sign for our world today. It's about, and also it's this exhibition is about our Western values, the values of freedom, and that we have to defend them. That is what we do not teach, as Lewis said, but it's one of the key messages that if you, because this exhibition will make you think, just as you said, it's not so long ago, it can happen again. And unfortunately, today we have more walls in the world than in 1989. And so therefore it makes people think, and we do hope that it makes them aware how fragile democracy is.
Does any of the wall still stand?
Yes. It's we do have approximately just 1% left. It was, as I said, 155 kilometers long. We do have approximately 1.5 kilometers in the very center of Berlin, and the Berlin Wall Foundation is responsible to for looking after it.
Do people still urinate on it?
Well, we do not,
because I did.
I know,
Scott.
I did.
Well, we call them the wallpeckers, and and the wallpeckers.
I didn't know we had a name.
Yes, you did. And the wallpeckers that come to us today, we try to explain that this is cultural heritage and this is a very meaningful object, and that they should, they are very welcome to photograph the place. And yes, but that's the way it is. It's not an ordinary, it's a listed building.
Yeah.
It's a listed built structure, but of course, I mean, it's different as well. It's a very modern thing, and we have to live with that, that every now and then people like you come along.
Yep.
And
is it also,
pecker about.
Is it also not important just to maintain, have the reminder that this happened right here?
Yeah.
To keep a peace there.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And that is, it's like a, what I always refer to, it's like a horizontal stepping stone. I mean, you it makes people think. As we are all very good tourists and we go to places, although we have AI, we have all the images in the world, but we go there to touch it. We want to see it. We want to believe that it's true. And that is what I mean. Many, many people from all over the world come to Berlin to actually to believe it, because they can't believe a dictatorship overcome without a single shot fire. How is that possible? And so they come and touch it.
Describe that night in 1989.
It was a very long night, and it started with a press conference in the early evening, and the press conference was done by the East German government, and the head of press, Günter Schabowski, announced by pure mistake, really, that the border is open. And two journalists, one Italian and one German, they ask him, what do you mean by it's open? Because they were negotiating about the travel regulations that was actually to be taken place the following day. And then Schabowski, the head of press, was not very well informed. And then he said, to my knowledge, it's immediate. Now.
Oh.
So, and it's from then on.
Had the Soviet Union already collapsed?
No. The Soviet Union was still sort of as it was. It was with Gorbachev in power ever since 1985. So it was there. And they were not informed. And so this was a mistake, one of the miraculous mistakes in world history. So people in East Berlin immediately rushed to the checkpoint.
Yes.
And said, we want to go into the West, because Schabowski, head of press, said it's open. and the border guards were left at the border, at the crossing point, without any orders. And they were completely helpless. You must imagine these guys.
Thousands and thousands and thousands of people.
Exactly. Sort of pressing at the border checkpoint, and these poor border guards without any order what to do. Until then, they were actually ordered to shoot them. But they could not shoot these masses of people. And then one border guard at close to midnight, at nearly 11:30, he literally said, okay, we will flood it now, he said.
Flood it.
So, and then he opened a barrier, a checkpoint, and these masses went into the west, and then that was it. And from that very night on...
And the wall just starts coming down. Yeah,
it was coming down, and the wall was history because there was no way back.
Wow.
One more segment.
Do you have to go? You probably have to go. They have an exhibit opening.
No, we can stay.
Can you stay
for one
more?
We'll be happy to stay. Absolutely.
Doctor, this is just phenomenal.
This is fascinating. I love it. All right, we will continue in just a moment. The Berlin Wall exhibit opens this week at Union Station.
We just keep talking
in here. The conversation off the air is as good as the one on the air.
So I didn't want to ask a dumb question, but it turns out maybe the question isn't so dumb. Maybe just in my mind it was. That there was no warning for this when the wall went up. But the physical wall obviously did not go up overnight. Explain how this happened, where families were separated overnight with the announcement, but not necessarily the physical structure of the wall yet.
Well, you must imagine at the end of July 1961, just 2 or 3 weeks before the wall went up, we had approximately 2,000 refugees and escapees every day, 2,000 a day from east to west. And so the East German regime had to act, and they said, okay, apparently West Berlin and the West German is so attractive, we have to do it. They got permission from the Soviet Union, so the then head of state in East Germany, Walter Ulbricht, constantly traveled to Moscow because he needed permission from Moscow. It was East Berlin was not a state that could act on their own. So they, you know, anyway, in the early August, they got permission by Khrushchev to get to build this wall and to close off the border sectors. And so that was why there was no warning. So it was a surprise event. The East German regime had learned from the first upheaval against the regime in 1953, where they were not prepared for an uprising in the East. So they needed the Soviet and Soviet tanks to defend their state and their regime. So they prepared it very well. They got material from all over the country secretly to the outskirts of East Berlin, and then did it from a Saturday to a Sunday overnight.
Like the barbed wire.
With the barbed wire, no warning. By the end of the year 1961, so in the first 4 or 5 months, they made a first generation of wall, as we always refer to it, and that was 5 kilometers long, only in the very center. The rest was barbed wire, but the actual entire system of the wall, the sequence of obstacles, was built for the next 28 years.
You said they were even still building it as we started tearing it down.
And it's even worse. The wall was politically overcome on November 9th, 1989. And the border guards were still physically improving the wall, although the city was already open. And there was an order on the 21st of December, 89, to stop improving the wall. So although
you lost.
The city
was, it's coming down.
Yeah, it's coming down. You lost. It's the city was open, but still border guards were forced to repair bits and pieces here and there. Although everyone could walk through it and drive through it at the checkpoint, which is ridiculous.
So the Berlin Wall exhibit opens this week at Union Station. Doctor, lastly, we have 1 minute left. What do you want people to take away from this exhibit? What do you want them to learn and remember?
It was a man-made decision to build this wall, and it was the people's wish to overcome it. Freedom is not stoppable. It's all about freedom, democracy, Western values, and we have to defend them today. That is what the wall exhibition shows, by especially individual stories.
We are so, so thankful and lucky to have it here. The first time in the United States, and it's at Union Station. Dr. Axel Klausman, thank you, thank you. And Luis Ferrero, I am so happy to see you again. This is the second time you've been.
Wonderful.
You are welcome anytime.
Thank you.
Please go get your tickets
online,
unionstation.org, unionstation.org. It is here through or up to the end of the year. So plenty of time to go check it out. Please, please do. We are so fortunate to have it. Thank you both.
Thanks for listening to the Dana and Parks podcast. Remember, you can catch us online anytime at kmbz.com.